Terrific to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Coming up in our next segment after this one, we open up the phones to hear from those of you that attended schools where mandatory desegregation happened in the 1970s. I was part of the second class at Crozier Junior High School in Inglewood that was subject to court-ordered desegregation as part of the Inglewood School District. And very vivid memories of what that experience was like. And I'd like to hear yours. If you were a student who was bused, if you attended a school where busing had a big impact, what were the effects of that, positively, negatively, just interestingly, that came from that experience? This has come up as a part of the Democratic presidential race with Senator Kamala Harris and former VP Joe Biden going back and forth over their impressions of court-ordered desegregation through busing. That's a little bit later this hour. But right now, we turn our attention to the U.S. Supreme Court and its recently concluded term. The question was, with the departure of Justice Anthony Kennedy, who would be the swing vote? What would be any of the potential fissures or differences between the conservatives who were on the court, which make up the majority now? And joining us to talk about what we've seen and what we potential glean relevant to the next term is Amy Howe, the co-founder of SCOTUS Blog and the author of the blog Howe on the Court. Amy, good to have you with us again.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So, were there any surprises for you, in particularly among the conservative wing of the court, how they differentiated themselves?
It was, I think, one of the biggest surprises. I don't know if it was a surprise, but just sort of a reminder that, you know, not all conservative justices are created equal. You don't sort of go online and order a conservative justice. And in particular, Justice Brett Kavanaugh, the court's newest justice, and Justice Neil Gorsuch, you know, they were both appointed by the same president. They're roughly the same age. They even attended the same all-male Catholic high school. But they didn't always vote the same. They only agreed. Justice Kavanaugh actually was in the majority the most of any justice on the Supreme Court. He was in the majority 91%. He only agreed with Justice Gorsuch at the same rate that he agreed with Justice Stephen Breyer and Justice Elena Kagan, who we think of as part of the court's more liberal bloc. So, you know, that was a little bit of a, I don't know if it was a surprise, but it's certainly interesting to watch and a reminder that you can't always predict the way people are going to vote. Justice Gorsuch, you know, on the other hand, was all of the court's more conservative justices sort of crossed over to vote with the four liberals in 5-4 cases. Those are the ones that in which the court is the most closely divided. They're often the cases that we, the reporters and the public care the most about. And Justice Gorsuch was actually the one, the conservative justice, who did it the most with four different cases in which he crossed over.
We're talking with Amy Howe, co-founder of SCOTUS Blog. My apologies about the dropouts on her audio. We'll try and get that corrected right now. Also with us, Wall Street Journal Supreme Court correspondent Jess Braven. Jess, good to have you back with us. Let's talk a little bit about the role of the Chief Justice and what role is he assuming with the new composition of the court?
Well, Chief Justice Roberts has, I'd say, two principal concerns that we've seen over the years. One is he is a very conservative lawyer, and he has beliefs that have developed over decades in the right way to look at the law, and they tend to go strongly to the right. He's very pro-business. He tends to be sympathetic to prosecutors, all of the hallmarks we would have of a conservative justice. On the other hand, he also has a very deep concern for the institutional credibility of the court and the place of the Supreme Court within the larger government framework. And he knows, as a lawyer who's argued both sides of cases and has experience in different branches of government, that you have to have some credibility from the people on the other side, people who disagree with you, and that the decisions, if they all seem to be extremely aggressive moves to implement a particular ideology, that diminishes the acceptance of the court and the respect for the court and its credibility among people who may not agree with those decisions yet have strong reasons of their own. So we saw, I would say, most dramatically at the last moment of the term when the Chief Justice, joined by those liberal members, blocked President Trump from proceeding with a citizenship question on the census form, calling out the administration for what he said were apparently contrived reasons presented to the lower courts for putting that question there. So I'd say that we saw both of those strands present for the Chief Justice as he tries to steer the court to the right, but do so in a way that makes it seem like this is a legal institution and not just another branch of the political infighting in Washington.
Seemed like in the most controversial cases that the liberal bloc hung together. Is that historically consistent, that liberals tend to be more of a bloc on the court, more reliable in terms of their interpretation of the Constitution than conservative justices?
Well, since pretty much 1971 or so, the liberals have been the minority on the Supreme Court ever since President Nixon put four appointees on the court just a couple years within the retirement of Chief Justice Earl Warren. So they have a lot of experience in dissenting and in trying to mitigate what they view as wrongheaded directions by a moderate to conservative and now strongly conservative majority. So when what you're trying to do is really stop the majority from taking the court in the wrong direction, as opposed to initiate new interpretations of the law or expand approaches to the law as new cases come up in line with your philosophy, maybe it's not that surprising that they're most cohesive when they're dissenting or when they can persuade one of the conservatives to join them in a view. If a conservative is going to, crossover makes it seem very partisan. I don't know if that's exactly the right model, but to get someone who typically disagrees with them to join their view of things, such as they used to do with Justice Anthony Kennedy in death penalty cases or in gay rights cases, they're not going to want to rock the boat. I mean, they're going to want to agree to everything that justice might want, because the shakiest member of the majority coalition is the one who's going to get his way for fear of losing that vote. So I don't know that it is naturally because they are liberal as opposed to conservative. I think it may
be minority status.
That they're in the minority.
Yeah. So that's interesting. You think if the conservatives were in the minority, they would be consistent and essentially their decisions would be as a bloc.
That may be, although just to undercut my own thesis, when the court found a constitutional basis for same-sex marriage, there were four different dissents by each of the four conservatives who disagreed with the single majority opinion by Justice Kennedy. So, maybe it has to do with these individuals and how they're they look at things. So I guess the thing is, and Amy has access to all those great statistics that appear on SCOTUS blog. There's a lot of empirical analysis of what the Supreme Court does, but the sample is so small. We're talking about such a tiny handful of people over such a long period of years that it's not the same thing as looking at broad statistics involving even the Congress, much less any other social trends.
Yeah, an excellent point you make. We're talking with Jess Braven, Wall Street Journal Supreme Court correspondent, also the co-founder of SCOTUS blog. Amy Howe is with us, also writes the blog Howe on the Court. If you have questions for them about the U.S. Supreme Court term recently concluded, as well as the big cases the court has already agreed to take on in the coming term this fall, we're at 866-893-KPCC, 866-893-5722. There's also the AirTalk page at kpcc.org. Amy Howe, do you feel like after this term, all the decisions that have been issued, that you have a clearer sense of where the justices might go for the next term?
It's hard to say. I mean, there was a real sense this term that the justices were trying to avoid conflict as much as they can, whether it was because of the contentious confirmation hearings for Justice Kavanaugh. You know, there's a saying, I think, attributed to Justice Byron White, that every time that the court gets a new justice, it's like a different court. So the idea that they're still kind of getting their footing with the new lineup on the court, it really changes the dynamic. And so, you know, if you look closely at a lot of the high profile cases that they decided this term, when you're talking about partisan gerrymandering, the census case, those are really cases that they were more or less kind of boxed into taking. The Supreme Court has extraordinary discretion over the cases that it decides to hear, except when it comes to redistricting cases. And so partisan gerrymandering, they didn't have a lot of options. The redistricting cases have an automatic right to appeal to the Supreme Court. The census case, of course, they could have turned it down, but it would have been really unusual to allow a lower court ruling to stand saying that the government couldn't include this question on the census. I think they felt like they had to weigh in on it. You know, on the other hand, they turned down a lot of high profile issues, or sort of disposed of them in a rather summary way. So I think we're going to get a much better sense of what this new version of the Roberts Court looks like next term, when they take on DACA, when they take on, you know, whether or not federal employment protections that apply to LGBT employees, potentially gun rights cases. It's going to be an interesting term, and it's all going to happen in the context of the presidential election. So there'll be a focus, I think, on the Supreme Court as an institution, and the significance of the lineup of the court as potentially a factor in the presidential election season.
Gives us so many great cases to talk about on the program. So I'm looking forward to debating these important cases coming before the U.S. Supreme Court. In case you just tuned in, we're discussing the recently concluded term of the Supreme Court and looking ahead to the next one beginning in the fall. Also looking at what we're learning about the justices themselves and the ways that they came down on these important decisions. Justice Elena Kagan seems to be raising her profile with this most recent term. And Amy Howe, I wonder if you could speak to that, because, of course, Justice Ginsburg has had such a prominent role in writing even dissenting opinions that have been, you know, very pointed. And it seems like Justice Kagan did that this term.
That's right. I think probably the dissenting opinion that we're all going to remember from this term is Justice Kagan's dissenting opinion in the partisan gerrymandering case. It's considered sort of a statement to read your dissenting opinion from the bench. It signals that you're really unhappy with how the case turned out. And it's something that's only done a couple of times each term. And Justice Kagan in particular is not someone who does it lightly. The tradition at the Supreme Court is that the senior justice in the majority or the dissent gets to assign the opinion or the dissenting opinion. And so Justice Kagan's dissenting opinion in the partisan gerrymandering case is something that Justice Ginsburg would have assigned to her. But you know, she's really, you know, perhaps she's one of the most compelling, if not the most compelling writers on the Supreme Court. So I don't think that it's a coincidence that Justice Ginsburg assigned this really high-profile dissenting opinion to her, and she read it from the bench. And you know, we don't think of Justice Kagan as a particularly passionate person in the way that we think of, you know, some of the other justices. But and I wasn't in the courtroom, but reporters who were there say that she spoke towards the end, you know, that she, you know, almost seemed as if she were close to tears in reading her dissent from the bench. And there's a really unusual line at the end when she said, you know, with respect and sadness, you know, I dissent from the decision. So but certainly what we have seen her, you know, before, but this was really one of the highest profile dissents that she's had so far.
Amy and Jess, thank you both for being with us. We appreciate it very much. Talking about the Supreme Court, Amy Howe of SCOTUS Blog and Howe on the Court, Jess Braven, Wall Street Journal Supreme Court correspondent. Coming right up after our update, we're going to open the phones to hear from listeners who, like me, went to a public school where there was court-ordered desegregation through busing. quite a few of us here in Southern California, but also other parts of the country. That court order to desegregate hit a number of urban areas, and it enabled students who otherwise wouldn't have had opportunities for a wider array of classes and stronger teachers and better facilities to attend those schools. But there were definitely trade-offs. This is not just a clear-cut, all is great or all was terrible issue. I want to hear the nuances from you as someone who experienced that court-ordered desegregation through busing. We're at 866-893-KPCC or the AirTalk page, kpcc.org. Back after a live update from Julie Slater.